WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, in for Terry Gross. When Oliver North emailed John Poindexter in September 1986 about a secret CIA airstrip in Costa Rica used to supply the Contras, he never even stopped to think that message would ever see the light of day. But that informal memo about top secret information is now in a book with many other revealing, embarrassing, and inane intra-office communications called White House Email. The last three presidents all fought the public release of its email. Reagan tried to erase the computer backup tapes his last week in office. Bush signed a secret deal with the archivists of the United States just before midnight on his last day in office for him to take the email with him to Texas. And Clinton tried a technical maneuver to move the email out of reach of the Freedom of Information Act. But the National Security Archives, a nonprofit organization interested in the disclosure of government records, won its lawsuit to get the email released. Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archives and the man who went through the 45,000 email messages they received from the White House. I asked Tom Blanton why it was important to get the email released.
I think the most amazing thing to me about what we learned about the White House email system was that these top White House officials were really using this system to get around the normal kinds of records laws and the normal process of pushing paper, doing memos, writing decisions down in formal documents. And instead, they were chatting by computer and working out the policy, thinking the whole time that none of this email was going to survive. Nobody was ever going to get to see it. And so they were avoiding accountability, which in our democratic society, in a way, at the White House, is the ultimate sin. And so I think the reason it was so important for us to fight this thing for 7 years now, three different presidents, was precisely because the White House staff thought they were getting away with something. And that's, I think, the amazing thing about the email themselves is they thought nobody would ever read this stuff.
Well, three administrations, the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, and the Clinton administration really tried to block access to this email. What legal arguments did they use?
Well, the first time around, the Reagan administration actually tried to erase all the tapes. I mean, what's interesting about this, you know, Ollie North tried to delete his messages on his way out of the White House as Iran-Contra was breaking, but they ended up being saved on all these backup tapes. Well, at the end of the Reagan administration, Colin Powell was the National Security Advisor, and he ordered all these backup tapes to be recycled, overwritten with new data. We went to court when we found out about this with just a day or a day and a half left in the Reagan administration in January of 89 and got a court order to stop the destruction. And the fundamental argument the government made was, oh, these email, they're just like little telephone message slips. They're just, you know, a name and maybe a number and please call me back. There was nothing substantive about them. And they went ahead with that argument even though we could show them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of email messages written by the National Security Advisor of the United States, John Poindexter, and Oliver North, laying out all of their Iran-Contra dealings. This is the place where they really wrote it all down.
Is there anything, though, private and off-limits at the White House when it comes to conversations and documents?
Absolutely. And the government does have some very strong privacy protections, particularly the U.S. Privacy Act, where they don't have to release any email that is about, say, a staff person's family or medical appointments or problems or personal finances or even, you know, employment reviews and that kind of thing. That's all covered, and I totally support that. In fact, you know, during the litigation, every time the government made a privacy claim and said, oh, this piece of email is really personal and private, or this section of an email is personal, we didn't challenge it as plaintiffs. We said, no, we agree. We think any good freedom of information regime has to have good privacy protections, or else it's a farce. The government is exercising its power by trampling on our individual rights and the rights of employees.
Do you think there's a need, though, for public officials to be able to speak off the record, off the cuff, without being exposed and without being having the fear of being exposed?
Yes, I think there is. And at the same time, I think that has to be limited, because if you have an absolute right for public officials to speak off the record in order to speak candidly and have really honest discussions, well, then there's no way for anybody, any of the rest of us as citizens or journalists or scholars, to really find out what happened, what went into the decision. And so I think all of our laws, including the Freedom of Information Act, have a kind of a balance in a way which says, you know, there are exemptions to freedom of information for deliberative material that would chill expressions of views. Under the Presidential Records Act, you have to wait 5 or 10 years after a president leaves office before you can get the documents of his or her top advisors. And I think that's a reasonable balance. And here in the White House email, though, they weren't striking any balance at all. They weren't saying, oh, we're going to set it aside for 10 years from now. They were saying, we're going to destroy it. You'll never get it.
Do you see email as the equivalent of a diary or the equivalent of the White House tapes that Nixon made when he was in office?
It's closer to the White House tapes because it's conversation by computer, and it has a lot of that instantaneous quality of a phone call where people or this White House staffers had an email note on their screen and they just typed in their response and zap, sent it off, and it instantly arrived at the recipient's computer. And it has a real off-the-cuff and raw quality to it that makes it amazing reading. And I think that's what it is, more than say a diary. Each of these email messages was sent to another top White House staff person or several such staff people. So from my way of thinking, that's much closer to a Watergate tape, and it's much closer to exactly the kind of record that history requires us to save.
You know what I found a curious omission, at least the email that you published in your book? There's mm-hmm. no presidential email. We see no email from either President Bush or President Reagan.
Isn't that amazing? I think it's a generational thing in a way, because we know, for example, that Bill Clinton and Al Gore both use the computer and both send email, and Gore has actually gone on some of these online chats and responded to people's email, but there's no evidence in anything that we've seen during the 7 years of the court battle that either President Reagan or President Bush ever sat down at a computer terminal and typed out an email. If you remember George Bush and that supermarket scanner incident where he didn't quite know what the barcode thing was all about, you can see that these guys were not exactly computer literate. But what is amazing is that all of their top staff were using it. And in fact, most of the business, certainly in the national security staff at the White House, was all taking place on email.
You just said that all of the business of the National Security Council was done on email. Is that right?
What's amazing to me is how much of the business was done on email. What might ordinarily take place in a conference call among staff or at a staff meeting, by the 1980s, the staff was so large. I mean, you had something like 150 full-time professionals just working on the national security staff at the White House. Those folks couldn't even get in the same room together to work out projects. And it was very difficult for them, according to their own email and their own memoirs, even to reach each other on the phone because they were all tied up in meetings. You look at some of the email schedules for some of these people, like Colin Powell. We have his daily schedules that were put up on the email system for other staffers to look at. He was scheduled down to the 2-minute increments during a normal working day at the White House. And because of that, because of the phone tag and the incredibly tight schedules, they had to use email just to communicate, just to let each other know what they were doing, to get decisions moved forward, to alert people, you got to sign off on this memo, or King Hussein is coming to town and we got to set up the Oval Office for this. This is how they got it done. It was instant. You could be guaranteed that people would sit down at the end of the day and look at it, whereas you might never get a phone call returned for days at a time.
What then is the overall impression that you get looking at the email that came out of both the Bush and the Reagan White House?
I think the first and really overall impression is just how candid it is. I mean, we may never see email like this again now that my book is out, but at the time, the White House staff really believed none of it was going to survive, that my book would never exist, that the public would never see their email. So they said things about each other, about key players on Capitol Hill, about, you know, foreign dictators ranging, you know, Noriega to Saddam, or, you know, Bob Dole to Ross Perot, that I don't think they would ever have said in public. They would never have said if they knew it was going to become public. It's like talk. It's chat in an interesting way. It's very different from many the other declassified documents that I've seen over the years that are much more formal, much more written for the file or for history or as a official decision document. This is the way they actually talk when they think nobody is listening.
Well, a fair amount of the email does deal with what came to be called the Iran-Contra scandal. This is a piece of American history that you have looked at through official documents and through testimony. Did you learn anything else, anything new and different about what happened in that chapter in the administration history that you didn't know from official documents?
We learned a lot about Iran-Contra, I think, through this email. The first time around, the email that came out early in Iran-Contra really was the way that investigators like the Tower Commission could even figure out who did what to whom and find out that Ollie North wasn't a lone cowboy out there. He was part of the herd. He was regularly communicating with his bosses. But the new email that came out as a result of our lawsuit has incredible details that were censored the first time around when the first set of email was released. So you have North and Poindexter and others trying to intimidate Oscar Arias, the future Nobel Prize winner, president of Costa Rica, into not exposing their little secret operations in Central America. And you have this extraordinary email, for example, about Manuel Noriega, where at one point Noriega approaches Ollie North, who says, "I've developed a pretty good relationship with him over the years," fascinating little detail in itself, and offers to bump off the Sandinista leaders if the White House would help him, Noriega, quote, clean up his image, unquote. And so North writes an email describing all this to his boss, the National Security Advisor. The boss writes back and says, well, you know, we can't get involved in any assassination, but, you know, he might have some assets for sabotage. And, you know, quote, I have nothing against him other than his illegal activities, unquote. Which my jaw just hit the floor.
So what does that tell you? I mean, as you say, these are our officials thinking out loud, talking to each other in what they consider to be very private conversations.
Exactly.
What does that tell you?
It tells you how far they were willing to go in the 1980s to pursue these policies that they knew President Reagan was strongly behind supporting the Nicaraguan Contras. What the email tells you is that the top White House staff were willing to cut deals with known murderers and drug traffickers. Noriega had been exposed 3 months before this email on the front page of the New York Times, had been exposed as a murdering opponents and part of the cartel money laundering apparatus and so forth. That's why he needed help from the White House to clean up his image. And yet they were willing to work out arrangements with him. It's an amazing, astonishing degree of willingness to bend and break the law, I think.
That's Tom Blanton, our guest today on Fresh Air. He's the executive director of the National Security Archive and the author of a new book called White House Email, and it's email that was gotten through the courts from the Reagan and Bush White House. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Blanton, executive director of the National Security Archive and author of White House Email. There's some very public players, a McFarlane, North, Poindexter, public because of a lot of the testimony that they had to give as a result of Iran-Contra. What kind of portrait emerges from them from the email? Do you get a different picture of them than someone might get just from their public testimony?
Well, in the email, you definitely see more of the sense of humor, particularly from Oliver North, who is one of the most distinctive voices on the whole email system. He has this one, I think, very funny email that he's writing to another staffer where he says, you know, "Oh, Lord, I lost the slip and broke one of the high heels. Forgive, please. We'll return the slip on Monday. Your pal, the Ayatollah." And you can hear sort of him laughing and the recipient. As it turns out, it was both a serious and a funny email. He had just come back from some overseas undercover mission, and he was apparently wearing a disguise. And so this senior staffer, who was a woman at the White House, offered him the next time he needed a disguise to take some of her dresses and wigs. And so he's writing back thanking her for this with a little joke. You get a sense of that personal voice, which is, to me, very fascinating. Or another example, which I really enjoyed, Colin Powell, as National Security Advisor. His top aide asks him in late 1987, gee, you feel, you know, secure, you know, going back and forth to the office? Are you, you know, you sufficient guards, security, whatever? And Powell says, yeah, well, I feel fine. I try to vary my schedule a little bit to cover the threat. And, quote, I had an alarmed house when I lived at Fort McNair earlier this year. Pain in the neck, scared hell out of the family initially, and then became amusing when the MPs assaulted the house every time the alarm misfired, unquote. You really get a feel. That's Colin Powell's real voice there, and it humanizes these folks at the top of the power pyramid within the U.S. government. I think that's one of the great things about the email is you actually see them not only as policymakers, not only as very powerful people, but also as human beings.
Well, one of the things I found, and this, I guess, is part of the inane entries of email, was a letter having to do with toe markers and a particular White House event and the question of making sure that everyone was seated at the proper table and that the kind of protocol of a lunch or a dinner was followed to the letter of the law. And I just thought, isn't it interesting how these details can take on such magnitude?
Exactly. And how many people on the White House staff it takes to take care of these details. I mean, that particular email message was arranging for an Oval Office meeting where King Hussein of Jordan was going to come in and sit down with President Reagan. And it's just amazing that the email is almost 2 pages long and all the people they have to inform and where you put toe markers for people to stand and how they screwed up the last couple of times. And it's amazing how much work goes into what the Reagan administration was known for, which was beautiful photo ops. The whole idea was get up a nice visual that shows the president, you know, talking mano a mano with top world leaders that makes him look more presidential and scores points politically. I mean, it's fascinating to see how many inane details go into these spectacular photo ops.
What do you think the effect of publishing this email is having or is going to have on the Clinton White House? Do you think that they're going to be more self-conscious, more circumspect when it comes to sending email from one person to the next?
I do think so. And I think that effect already even happened in the Bush White House because we had won in the first round of our lawsuit to save the tapes from the Reagan years. And my bet is there are something like 4,800 tape cartridges from the Bush White House that our lawsuit saved. My bet is that email will not be quite as candid as what Ollie North wrote back in the mid-1980s. And I bet in the Clinton years, it will be even less candid, or people just won't use the email to try to make their communications. And at the same time, there's something about the email that just draws out that candidness, almost in spite of yourself, the instantaneousness of the response and the off-the-cuff response. You know, if you read some of the email that even now has been turned over by some of the Clinton White House staff to congressional investigators of this or that different affair, it's amazingly candid for what it does say.
Now, how candid are you when you email, knowing that whatever you say could be saved and found by somebody else?
You bet. Well, in my book, I suggest something I call the front page rule. And actually, believe it or not, I got this idea from the CIA. They announced about 2 years ago that before they undertake any covert actions these days in the post-Cold War era, that they judge the proposed covert action by a variety of criteria, the cost and the benefit and so forth. One of the criteria they judge it by is, will we be proud of this covert action? When, not if, it shows up on the front page. And if we'd be proud of it, then they think, oh, we should go forward. Well, in a way, that's not such a bad rule for me or for any other email user to follow, because I think we might all do with a little more civility and a little less flaming in our electronic communications.
So when you want to say something that might end up on the front page, but you feel like you don't want it to, does that mean you pick up the phone?
Yeah, I think most people do. Sometimes, you know, if the key question for email users who expect some privacy from their email is, who else gets to see it? Mm-hmm. Where does it exist? Who's the systems operator? who runs the mainframe or the server or the network that has your email. And I think one of the lessons of the White House email case is that we all ought to find that out, because those folks, those systems operators, they have a lot of power over our privacy and over our information. So if you don't know where it exists, go find out. And then also think about who else gets to see it. I mean, if you send your email over networks like America Online or across the internet, it's protected in that electronic communication. But if you use email within I'm at George Washington University, if I just use email within the university system, the university has some rules about access, but really the systems operators at the university's computer center could, if they wanted to, read my email. Practically speaking, they don't, because there are thousands of students and other users. It would overwhelm them to try to read it. But if you're in a corporate environment, there's some real consequences. There's a major case out at Epson in California where a woman got fired because in her email, which she thought was private, she made some comments about a supervisor, and the systems operator gave it to the supervisor, and the courts, all the way up to the California Supreme Court, said, oh, that email doesn't belong to you, the email writer. It belongs to the company that gave you the computers and that set up the network internally. So it's, I think, a good lesson for all of us from the White House staff. You know where your email is backed up and think about it as if it could be public someday.
Well, Tom Blanton, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archives and author of the new book, White House Email. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.